Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending Saturday the 4th of May 2024. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme, and I hope you all had a very good April. This edition of Primary will once again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, then it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Amongst other items, this edition has, as usual, on the USB stick distribution only, the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings. Once again, we'll be delving into the London Beyond Sight archives, this time a description of Bedford Park by Peter Murray. There will also be the list of audio described programmes on television, courtesy of the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper, and Peter Burley will be presenting his look at events and entertainment in our area. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdates in the upcoming week. This week's music is Eternal Feelings by local composer Gothby. Let's move on to the news read by Christine, David, Deborah, Andy, Jane and Keith.
This is Keith McDougall. 24-year-old's 800 miles solo challenge. 24-year-old Fraser Rosser-Smith has set himself the challenge of completing a 60-day solo pilgrimage from Geneva to Rome along the 800-mile Via Francigena. The Harpenden Explorer will undertake his journey along the ancient cross-nation route on May the 14th in aid of the Harpenden Men Camp charity. Fraser will travel over the Alps, crossing the snowdrifts of the Great Sir Bernard Pass, before making his descent into Italy and ending his journey at the Vatican. He hopes to reach Rome and the independent nation of the Vatican in early July. Since the Middle Ages, the Via Francigena has operated as the major pilgrim route from Western Europe to Rome. Raising money for Harpenden Men Camp, Fraser's brother lives with Down syndrome and requires significant support so that he may live an independent, fulfilling life. He's raised more than £1,200 via a Just Giving page so far. Fraser said, "I'm sure this adventure will have its challenges, but it also looks to be great fun, and I can't wait to get started. It's common for people to undertake such treks in the name of a charity. Therefore, I'll be walking for Harpenden Men Camp, an organisation close to my heart, which aims to offer local Harpenden individuals with a learning disability the support they require to lead an enriched and fulfilling life. Harpenden Men Camp does vital work in our community, supporting and, most importantly, enabling adults with a learning disability. Unfortunately, donations and fundraising for this local organisation have drastically fallen since the pandemic. It's my hope that, in my own small way, I can assist in their efforts to turn this around. God created us all in His own image. Too often our world views a learning disability as a mistake or a scientific mishap where something has gone wrong. I speak from personal experience when I say that it is nothing of the sort. It is a blessing. It is a gift. Those with additional complex needs enrich the world around them. Harpenden Men Camp works tirelessly to try and enrich their lives in return."
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley, and my first item is about a mystery hole that's finally been repaired by the council. Hertfordshire County Council has repaired a hole that appeared in St Albans pavement 1 year after it opened up in New Greens. The hole, situated near shops at High Oaks, was fixed last week, but a question remains over who owns the pit. A drainage cover has been removed from the site in April 2023 following damage, the cause of which is unknown. In an attempt to make the area safe, Hertfordshire County Council had placed a wheelie bin in the hole and erected plastic barriers around the location. Despite not knowing who owns the pit, the local authority took the decision to repair it anyway and charge the owner at a later date. A spokesperson for the local authority said last week, "We understand residents' frustration with the length of time it has taken to fix this broken drainage cover. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to identify who owns it and therefore who is responsible for repairing it. It doesn't appear to be part of the council's drainage system or belong to Thames Water. To avoid further delays, we've decided to repair the cover ourselves and recharge the owner once we have identified who that is." Now, there's a photograph here. This hole is not a natural hole in soil. It's in a pavement, sort of rectangular shape, and you can see down into it, and it's lined with bricks. So it's a man-made hole, and there's a photograph of some local residents sitting around it, and there's another photograph of it fully repaired. Well, it just looks like a rectangular-shaped sort of manhole cover that would go down to the drains.
Hello, my name's Andy. This article is headlined, "School Delighted at Good Rating." Ofsted says pupils are proud of their school. Trustees of a Harpenden school are delighted after it was given a good rating by Ofsted following an inspection. The report for Catherine Warrington School was published last Thursday and assessed the school in four areas. Personal development was rated as outstanding, while quality of education, behaviour and attitudes, and leadership and management were all rated good. The Ofsted report states, "Pupils are proud of their school. They flourish in the school's ethos of achievement and learning. Throughout the school day, pupils strive to live up to the school's expectations. They know that learning is important and approach their studies with genuine determination to do their best. Pupils benefit from the school's impressive character development programme. They take up the extensive opportunities to learn about mind, body and soul with great enthusiasm. Positive relationships are in place between pupils and their peers, as well as with staff. Pupils feel safe at school and are taught how to make safe choices in their lives. Staff and parents have confidence in leaders' work and are positive about the school." Catherine Warrington School's curriculum was also praised within the Ofsted report, along with staff at the institution. "The school's innovative and ambitious curriculum is well designed to ensure pupils learn knowledge in clearly measured steps. The curriculum provides teachers with clarity about the exact knowledge pupils know. Teachers deliver the curriculum effectively. They routinely check what pupils have learned." Catherine Warrington's head teacher, Mr. Martin, said, "The positive report highlights what we see every day here at KWS, with staff who go above and beyond to help and support our students. I'm sure you will join me in congratulating everyone who works and volunteers at our successful school." Jenny Howarth, the institution's Chair of Trustees, added, "As a new school, it has been important to us to create and develop a strong culture of knowledge, well-being and success valued by students, staff and families alike. Trustees are delighted that Ofsted recognised Catherine Warrington School's achievements in these regards in its initial report. We are very proud to be part of KWS."
Hello, I'm Jane Wilson, and my first article today is "Restaurant Given Top Hygiene Rating." An Italian restaurant in St Albans has been awarded the top food hygiene rating after previously being told that major improvement was required. Verdi's in Clarence Park was given a 5 out of 5 rating on Wednesday, April 17th, boosting its score from just 1 after a visit in January this year. According to the earlier report, hygienic food handling and cleanliness and condition of facilities and buildings both required improvement. Meanwhile, major improvement was necessary in the management of food safety category. However, these issues have been dealt with, and the restaurant has been rewarded with a new, improved rating. Rosie Cheek, restaurant manager at Verdi, said, "Naturally, we're delighted and wanted to share the good news. We would like to take the opportunity to thank our lovely, loyal customers who stood by us and supported us wholeheartedly. We really do appreciate them." On Sunday, May 26th, we will be hosting Jazz in the Park again. This will be the first of a free summer series, which will be held on the last Sunday of every month until September. And we can't wait to see everyone enjoying the music and park. Our deck chairs will be back in the park for May as well. These are free for all to use, and hopefully they will bring joy and some much-needed sunshine with them.
Hello, my name's Deborah. Tributes to a devoted wife. Eric Morecambe's widow, Joan, died on her 97th birthday. Joan Bartholomew, the widow of Harpenden's famous Eric Morecambe, sadly died on her 97th birthday following a short illness. Joan, who married the comedian in Margate in 1952, has been described as a devoted wife and the engine room of famous comedy duo Morecambe and Wise. She lived with Eric in Harpenden until his death nearly 40 years ago in May 1984, and the couple had three children together, a daughter Gail and sons Gary and Stephen. A statement issued on behalf of her children said, "It is with great sadness and the heaviest of hearts that we must share the news that our mother Joan has passed away peacefully at the age of 97 after a short illness. Our family kindly requests some privacy during this time while we grieve our sad loss." Joan's son, Gary Morecambe, later added, "Without her, there would never have been the Morecambe and Wise we knew and loved. She was the engine room that made the whole machine work." Joan was made an OBE for charitable services in the Queen's New Year Honours List in 2015 and was the founder and president of the Lady Taverners, part of the Lord's Taverners Youth Cricket and Disability Sports Charity. In 2003, she became the patron of the Supporters Trust for her late husband's favourite football team, Luton Town, a role she continued to carry out until her death. Tony Murray, chair of the Trust, told the BBC, "She's been our patron since the inception of the Trust, and it's very sad news. Lovely lady. Her support meant a lot to Luton fans, and she will be missed." Mrs. Bartholomew admitted in 2018 that she was still being stopped by Morecambe and Wise fans while shopping in Harpenden. She commented, "People don't seem to tire of them. They're everlasting, really." Harpenden's theatre, the Eric Morecambe Centre, was named after the great comedian. His comedy partner, Ernie Wise, sadly died in 1999, aged 73. And there are a couple of photos, one of Joan with a statue in honour of her husband Eric, and another with Joan Bartholomew, Eric Morecambe, and the then Prince Charles.
Special documentary screening sheds light on homelessness. More than 100 people gathered to view a screening of I'm Still Here, featuring a resident of the homelessness charity Emmaus Hertfordshire. After premiering in December, the documentary film, pieced together by Hope Film Limited, was shown at selected cinemas in London before its one-off screening at Harpenden's Rothamsted Conference Centre. The documentary features Chris, who joined Emmaus Hertfordshire in 2020 after being assisted by the Under One Sky charity, which is dedicated to aiding homeless people. Chris debuted on the big screen last year with a star-studded audience including Mick Jagger, his daughter Jade, and Elizabeth McGovern of Downton Abbey. Guests at the Hertfordshire screening included patrons of Emmaus Hertfordshire, Lord Charles Cecil and Lady Virginia Cecil, High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, Annie Brewster, and Mayor of St Albans, Councillor Anthony Rowlands. The evening was launched by Duncan Lewis, Chief Executive of Emmaus Hertfordshire. Mr Lewis said, When you see this film, I'm sure you'll agree that the message it conveys about the challenges of homelessness, and homelessness during a pandemic in particular, and also the positive power of volunteering, are both sobering and inspirational. We're delighted that Emmaus plays a small part in the story, and also that we can help to do our bit to help this film get to a wider audience. After the screening was a question and answer session with the film's director, Frank Vissers, Under One Sky's founder, Mikael Joel Iverson, Chris, companion at Emmaus Hertfordshire, and Curtis, a former companion of Emmaus, now working as a Rothamsted research chef. The film gives a powerful voice to Chris, affectionately referred to as Pops, and his contemporaries. It underscores the efforts of Under One Sky, who, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, stepped outside to extend help to vulnerable individuals. I'm Still Here aims at giving a voice to those on the streets. Thanks were also expressed on the night to a group of media students from the University of Hertfordshire who crafted a short film spotlighting the stories and journeys of Emmaus Hertfordshire residents and the support they had received.
And now this personal view from local MP Daisy Cooper. And this is headed, Rwanda Plan is immoral. The Rwanda Plan, first proposed by the Conservative government in April 2022, became law this week, but not without some 11th-hour parliamentary drama. In this final week, the bill passed between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, back and forth, in a process known as parliamentary ping-pong. This is essentially a process of negotiation, in which the number of amendments is whittled down until either the House of Lords decides to stop pushing the votes or the government offers them concessions. Politicians and journalists were bracing themselves for a long night with warnings that the back and forth could go on until as late as 2 or 3 in the morning. Over the course of one day, the number of amendments was whittled down from 6 to just 2. One amendment was about providing extra protections for Afghan interpreters who supported UK armed forces. The other was about whether Rwanda was a safe country or not. The government has, despite the evidence and a Supreme Court finding to the contrary, decided to simply declare that Rwanda is safe. This move had variously been described as trying to legislate that black is white, and led to some branding the legislation Orwellian and a post-truth bill. By around 10 p.m, the government had conceded on the first, and the House of Lords stopped pushing the second. For me, the passing of the bill was shameful. Liberal Democrats voted against the bill at every single opportunity, for 3 key reasons. The bill is inconceivably immoral, entirely unworkable, and eye-wateringly expensive. The £240 million that has already been spent on the scheme, without a single plane taking off, could have paid for 6,000 Home Office caseworkers who could have tackled the backlog of asylum cases, or 5.7 million GP appointments, and that sum could eventually double. As Chancellor, Rishi Sunak thought the scheme wasn't cost-effective, but as PM, he's pressing ahead. One can only assume he's hoping it will revive his political fortunes amongst the public, or at least protect him from a leadership challenge from his own backbenchers. Either way, with the NHS on its knees, a devastating cost of living crisis, and opposition parties vowing to repeal the Rwanda bill if they gain power, one really does have to wonder whether this is anything more than a desperate move from a desperately unpopular Prime Minister.
This article has the headline, Drop-in residents who identify as English. The number of St Albans residents who identify as English has fallen to just 28%, while those who identify as British has risen above their national average. With last Tuesday, April 23rd, being St George's Day, residents across England celebrated the country's patron saint and the history of the nation. However, the latest population survey from the Office for National Statistics covering 2023 has showed that just 28% of St Albans residents now identify as English. This has fallen from 40% in the year to June 2016, prior to the Brexit referendum. In 2004, 58% of St Albans residents identified as English. A total of 73% of the city's respondents to the survey said they identified as British, above the national average of 57%. Across England, the number of people identifying as English has broadly fallen over the last decade. Just 43% of people across the nation said they identified as English, down from 59% in 2004. Sundar Katwala, director of the British Future think tank, said, "People's sense of Englishness ebbs and flows. You'll see a lot of England flags in June when the Three Lions are competing in the Euros, and then they'll disappear again. Getting behind a shared English identity could help bring people together."
Care that's as unique as you. Rennie Grove Peace Hospice explains the personalised care it offers to people living in the area with life-limiting illnesses and how the care is tailored to individual needs. As a hospice care provider, Rennie Grove Peace offers personalised care to local people living with a life-limiting illness. But what does personalised care actually mean? Put simply, personalised care describes the way a person's care is tailored to all of their needs and preferences. This goes beyond medical needs to include everything that may impact them, whether it is physical or psychological, social or spiritual. Once a patient is referred to Rennie Grove Peace, their needs are recorded via the use of an holistic needs assessment. That's HNA. This is a tool used by healthcare professionals to identify a person's symptoms, concerns, or individual requirements. The results of this assessment are then used to create a completely tailored care plan. Helen is a Rennie Grove Peace nurse working with patients in their own homes. She explains, "When we meet a new patient, we carry out a full assessment to identify their individual needs and create a plan that's tailored to them. The form used for the assessment is the same for each patient, but the way we go through it varies by person. I start by asking, what is concerning the patient most? This means we can focus the discussion on their most pressing needs. We then work through the entire assessment as it may remind them of an issue that they had forgotten to mention. As soon as it's apparent they have another area of concern, we'll focus on that next, until we come up with a personalised plan of how we're going to address each of their needs. This personalised care plan can then be picked up by whichever member of the team visits them next, so everybody knows what the specific patient's needs are and how we're addressing them together. At Rennie Grove Peace, we know that a life-limiting diagnosis can affect every area of a person's life, as well as the lives of those around them. By taking into account all of a patient's needs when planning their care, we can help local people to live well for longer and give those around them peace of mind that everything is in hand." And there's a photograph here of a nurse in a violet-coloured uniform smiling at a gentleman that she's obviously been speaking to.
Coffee shop and bar owners thrilled to open new site. The owners of Fade to Black, a coffee shop and bar in St Albans, are thrilled to have opened a second site in the city. Situated at Trestle Arts Base in Russet Drive, the new establishment promises to bring the same blend of creativity, ambiance and hospitality that customers know from its original site in Marshallswick. The new coffee shop and bar offers the perfect backdrop for casual meetups, work sessions or evenings out with friends, according to its owners. Gary Smith, co-owner of Fade to Black, said, "Fade to Black Coffee Shop and Bar is thrilled to announce the opening of its second location in St Albans. Located at Trestle Arts Base, the new Fade to Black venue is nestled within the walls of a century-old chapel, lovingly transformed into a vibrant performing arts centre. Guests can expect the cosy ambience of a coffee shop with the lively atmosphere of a bar. We're excited to bring our unique blend of hospitality and creativity to another vibrant community in St Albans. In addition to its signature offerings, the new location will also host a variety of events, including live music nights and cinema nights, providing customers with memorable experiences that keep them coming back for more."
And this from the letters page from Tom Cuthbert on email. NHS Experiences. Your edition of April the 18th quotes the anonymous letter entitled NHS Difficulties. The author shows gratitude to the staff of Watford General while flagging up the difficulties of delays in appointments, getting an ambulance and attending the A&E department at Watford General. "I'm relieved the patient at Watford General received the timely care needed, but sadly it is not universal, and I imply no blame on NHS staff for this. Last week, my neighbour was referred to the Barnet General A&E by her local GP. As a young mother of a seven-year-old and a young baby, she preferred her husband to stay at home for her children and my wife to give her a lift to hospital. Her condition made it impossible for her to drive. At 7:30 p.m, my wife dropped her at the entrance to the Barnet General with instructions to call to be picked up. Parking at Barnet General is hugely problematic. By midnight, there was no response. Our neighbour had received a blood test, thereby losing her seat in the Barnet A&E, with 50 people waiting. There was standing room only. She texted us at 12:30, saying she still needed the antibiotics required and the results of the blood test. Our neighbour finally left Barnet General A&E at 4:45 a.m, with instructions to return to her GP to request antibiotics. At Deputy Prime Minister's question time, in response to the Labour MP Barbara Keeley, who stated Conservative ministers like to blame strikes and the pandemic for the appalling waiting times in the NHS, the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden, in whose Hartsmere constituency our neighbour lives, claimed Labour members like to pretend the pandemic did not happen. Mr Dowden said, "That is the cause of the pressure on the NHS. They complain about NHS performance while backing strikes by doctors, who unreasonably want a 35% rise. Despite all of those pressures, actually, A&E performance has improved in the past month." A polite response to the Deputy Prime Minister would demand a reality check, especially on his own constituents' experiences in Hartsmere.
Redbourne aims for best village event in county. Building on last year's success, Redbourne has set its sights on creating a county-leading weekend of sporting activities and fun. Active in Redbourne, AIR, and Verulam Cycling Club, VCC, in partnership with Redbourne Parish Council, RPC, are hosting the two-day free Redbourne Festival on July the 6th to 7th and aiming to beat the 4,000 visitors seen last year. AIR Festival organiser Chris Emmel said, "It is simply an example of how the Redbourne community can come together and create a fantastic event. We already have over 30 Redbourne organisations hosting free activities on Saturday, July the 6th. Free activities include tuk-tuk rides, beat the goalie, golf bunker challenge and stomp rocket record attempt, skittles and much, much more. This year there will be a free evening concert Redbourne Rocks, celebrating local talented musicians. The Sunday will see the unique bike event, VCC's Fête du Vélo, on Redbourne's public roads. This includes cycle racing round the common and a scooter-thon, and will be hosted by Eurosport's Jez Cox. Chris added, "This year we have many more local businesses and organisations involved, so we can offer a wider range of activities and thus ensuring there is something on offer for every age and ability."
According to this headline, City amongst toughest places to land a job in the UK. St Albans is among the toughest places to land a job in the UK, according to a recent study. Researching the most competitive job markets across the nation, Resume analysed LinkedIn data to see which towns and cities get the most and least applicants per job. St Albans was ranked as the sixth hardest place in the UK to find a new job. The city has an average of 2.88 daily applicants per job opening, behind Luton at 3.75 and ahead of Aberdeen at 2.29. London is the most competitive job market across the country with 11.01 daily applicants per job. Resume's Amanda Augustine said, "While it's no surprise to learn that London is home to the most competitive job market in the UK, I was surprised to see how sharp a drop-off in competition there is between London and the second most competitive town, Basildon, more than 50%. If job seekers wish to live in a city centre and face significantly less competition for work, I strongly recommend looking for vacancies that suit one's needs outside of London. It's interesting to see that the least competitive industries, who are also experiencing ongoing worker shortages, customer service, care and educational roles, are notorious for their thankless roles where employees often feel overworked, underappreciated and underpaid."
City second most costly for first-time buyers. St Albans has been named the most expensive city for first-time home buyers outside of London. A study conducted by Rightmove found that the city's average house price is £391,964, with a typical monthly mortgage repayment of £1,454. Behind London and St Albans on the list were Cambridge, Winchester and Oxford. St Albans was also found to be the fourth most expensive city to rent a property, with an average advertised rent of £1,509 a month. Across the UK, the cost of renting a two-bedroom or smaller home has increased by 39% in the last 5 years, compared with a 19% jump in the cost of buying a two-bedroom or smaller home. Rightmove's research looked at more than 50 cities across Britain. It made certain assumptions about mortgage costs, including that first-time buyers in Scotland and Wales had a 20% deposit and were taking out a 5-year fixed-rate mortgage at average rates. It also assumed that first-time buyers in England had a slightly higher deposit at 25%, reflecting industry averages for deposit sizes, and were taking out a 5-year mortgage. Rightmove's property expert Tim Bannister said, "These latest figures highlight why so many people remain determined to get onto the ladder, as the soaring cost of renting has meant buying has remained attractive, even with higher mortgage rates."
Hello, David Ireson here. Teacher shines in Britain's Got Talent. St Albans teacher Mike Woodhams has wowed the Britain's Got Talent judges with his portfolio of singing impressions. Mike Woodhams, who lives in Milton Keynes, teaches singing for schools across the St Albans area and for before and after school classes run by Performing Hearts. Mike's impressions of artists such as James Blunt, Boyzone, Macy Gray and Anastasia impressed Simon Cowell on the ITV show, earning the teacher 4 yeses and progression into the next round. BGT judge and singer Alicia Dixon, who hails from Welwyn Garden City, was particularly impressed by Mike's ability to cover both male and female artists with ease. Speaking on the show, Mike said, "The kids I teach will be very excited to see me on Britain's Got Talent, although I do feel that the Year Sixes will probably be harsher than the judges, which is scary." A spokesman for Performing Hearts described Mike as a fabulous teacher. They added, "The kids and staff are so proud of him and rooting for him to do well."
Former officer barred from policing. A former special police constable who sexually abused a boy will not be able to rejoin any police force when he gets out of prison. Hertfordshire's police chief ruled Craig Baker's name must be added to the College of Policing barred list at a misconduct hearing on Wednesday, April the 24th. Luton Crown Court handed Baker a 13-year sentence on March the 7th, 2024. Chief Constable Charlie Hall said, "I am ashamed at his behaviour, and equally ashamed he was ever associated with the constabulary. His behaviour has been disgraceful and an enormous breach of the expectations the public have on police to protect them from harm." Luton Crown Court found Baker of Crabtree Lane, Hemel Hempstead, guilty of 4 counts of sexual activity with a child. The 33-year-old is also guilty of 2 counts of taking indecent images of a child. In a case put forward by the police's Professional Standards Department for Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire, Chief Constable Hall said the incidents took place before Baker began his duties with Hertfordshire Constabulary. Chief Constable Hall said Baker's crimes and his conviction amounted to discreditable conduct and gross misconduct, and that had he not already left the force, he would have been dismissed.
The headline for this article is 6 fire engines tackle large blaze at derelict Park Street house. 6 fire engines attended the scene of a large blaze in the village of Park Street near St Albans. At 9:47 p.m. last Wednesday, April 24th, firefighters were sent to a derelict house in Park Street Lane, where they were faced with a large fire in a 2-storey building. Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service extinguished the blaze and remained at the scene until around 3 a.m. last Thursday. No injuries are reported to have taken place. A spokesperson for the service said last week, "Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service was called at 9:47 p.m. yesterday, Wednesday, April 24th, to reports of a fire in a derelict house in Park Street Lane, Park Street, St Albans. 6 fire engines were sent to the scene, where crews were faced with a large fire in a 2-storey building, with flames breaking through the roof. As the house had previously been used by squatters, firefighters were initially concerned that there may be someone inside, but fortunately the house turned out to be empty. Firefighters extinguished the fire and remained at the scene until shortly after 3 a.m, damping down the scene."
Generations bond for creative project. Pupils at Samuel Ryder Academy treated visitors to a creative spectacle last week as part of the Artists and Residents project arranged by St Albans Anna Chaplaincy. 3 members of the Hatfield Road Daycare Group came to see the school art studios on April the 25th and meet with students who were producing artwork for the project. The guests included Sue Davey, coordinator of daycare since its start in 1988, Brenda Quick, who lives near the school, and 97-year-old Peggy Liffin. The event coincided with Global Intergenerational Week, which celebrates interaction between the generations. Councillor Anthony Rowlands, Mayor of St Albans, said, "We were thrilled to visit Samuel Ryder's school art department to meet the visitors from Hatfield Road's daycare group and to see the students' work. The evident engagement between those present for this special occasion exemplifies what can be achieved by bringing together the generations. Congratulations to the students and teachers, to the daycare group, to the district council officers, and to the Anna Chaplaincy for making this happen. Artwork created by the students will be highlighted at the Mayor's Gala reception on May the 17th and will be included in a special event booklet."
A cocktail bar named Who House secures 2 a.m. last orders. Harpenden's cocktail and live music venue, Who House, can now stay open until 2:20 a.m. following a successful licensing review. District councillors have allowed the venue to stay open later on Friday and Saturday nights after a hearing on Tuesday, April the 23rd. Owner Andy Mills-Brown said the new opening times would not only benefit Who House, but really enrich the fabric of our town. Neighbours to the premises at 72 High Street had sent objections to St Albans City and District Council, which triggered the hearing. Mr Mills-Brown said, "We have worked hard to provide a range of entertainment catering to the varied interests and needs of our customers. We host a plethora of events, including live music from local musicians, psychic evenings, parties for the LGBTQ plus community, sports on our big screen, through to community coffee mornings. We are Harpenden Mums Group. We take great pride in providing a diverse and inclusive space." He added, "We prioritise the well-being of our customers and the surrounding community above all else. The venue's previous licence covered all 7 days of the week, and on Friday and Saturday nights, alcohol sales and live music had to stop at midnight. As part of the new licence, last orders can now take place at any time up until 2 a.m. Who House must employ security staff on the door and shut all doors and windows except for entry and egress after 10 p.m. Customers must not take drinks outside after 11 p.m. None of the responsible authorities, including Hertfordshire Constabulary, had objected to the application. A neighbour called Lisa told the licensing subcommittee, "Given that our high street is quite a residential high street, I just don't feel that these extended hours are appropriate for a place where it's highly residential. It doesn't feel like you're including us who live and sleep in this vicinity." Councillor Jill Haynes told her colleagues, "You've got a high street which is strung out where residential homes coexist with businesses, and up until so far, they coexist fairly well. But it wouldn't take much to upset what is quite a delicate balance. I think this licence application is one such."
How climate change affects food production. Climate change could dramatically alter the future of our food, warns Harpenden Society, ahead of a talk this month. James Clark, head of communications at Rothamsted Research, and Harpenden food teacher Catherine Tate will highlight growing pressure on the global agricultural chain at the event. James warns feeding the entire planet adequately by 2050 means doubling global food production. A feasible task only if farming methods become more sustainable, less reliant on chemicals, and more environmentally friendly. His talk will shed light on the critical problems farmers are grappling with and discuss how Rothamsted Research may pave the way to a sustainable food future. Following James, Catherine Tate will educate the attendees on the benefits of healthy eating and lifestyle adjustment. Catherine, a registered nutritional therapist, will share insights into how key foods and lifestyle changes can enhance our well-being. The meeting will be held at Catherine Warrington School on the Lower Luton Road, starting at 7:30 on Thursday, May the 16th. Free parking is available, but due to anticipated high demand, interested attendees are advised to reserve their seats at harpendonsociety.org.
Which areas of Hearts Council services should be scrutinised? Hertfordshire residents are being asked to put forward areas of County Council spending or services they would like to be put under the microscope. In the last 12 months, councillors have scrutinised council work in domestic abuse and dementia, women's safety and young people with barriers to improvement. They have also stepped in to review controversial decisions that have been called in, such as the sale of the former Radlett Aerodrome site. But all of these topics have been put forward by elected members of the County Council. Now, Chair of the Council's Overview and Scrutiny Committee, Councillor David Andrews, is appealing for members of the public to get involved too. He stresses that anyone can suggest areas of the Council's work, spending or decision-making they believe should face Council scrutiny by filling out a simple form. At a meeting of the Council's Overview and Scrutiny Committee on Tuesday, April the 23rd, he highlighted the process. The Councillor pointed to the Scrutiny Topic Suggestion Form, which is available on the Council's website at www.hertfordshire.gov.uk. Following the meeting, he said he was proud of the outcomes achieved by the scrutiny function of the County Council, but said County Councillors were just 78 people out of a county-wide population of 1.3 million.
And now the list of deaths as published in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Sheena Mary Hamshaw, 81. Felicity Mary French, 91. A little more music now, followed by John reading the national radio listings.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, May 4th. And earlier, with Jules Holland, an eclectic choice of music and chat, is on Radio 3 at 12 noon. Drama Chicken Soup with Barley by Arnold Wesker. It's a State of the Nation play, the lives of the Khan family between 1936 and 56 in London's East End. Radio 4 for this on Saturday, 3 o'clock. Alan Titchmarsh's Musical Choices are on Classic FM at 4, while Betrayal, Spies, three plays by Alan Bennett on Radio 4 Extra at 5pm, while Sounds of the 80s with Gary Davis is on Radio 2 at 8. Sunday, May 5th, and Stephen Mangan's Musical Choices include a section on Nocturnes, Classic FM for this, 4 o'clock. Nancy, the story of Nancy Astor, is on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30pm. While Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour is on Radio 2 at 7 on Sunday evening. And The Tragedy of Macbeth, a classic recording from 1971 with Joss Ackland and Googie Withers, Radio 3, 8pm. On to programmes then that are serialised throughout the working week, Monday to Friday. But of course, don't forget Monday is a bank holiday this week for May Day. But all these programmes, same time, same radio station, Monday to Friday. Lord Peter Wimsey, Clouds of Witness, is on Radio 4 Extra every day at 11am or 5pm. The Miners' Strike, Return Journey, is on Radio 4 at 4:45 to midday. Classical Live, this week featuring French music on Radio 3, every day, 1 o'clock. Girl with a Pearl Earring is on every day at 1:45 on Radio 4 Extra, or repeated in the evening at 7:45. Composer of the Week, on Radio 3, of course, at the new time of 4 o'clock, still getting used to that, and it's Bach. From Tuesday, the Fair Intellectual Club is on Radio 4 Extra at 7 in the evening all week, while Book of Bedtime starts Monday all the way through to Friday, and it's continued from last week. You are here. Radio 4, 10:45 p.m. On to Monday, May 6th, and the bank holiday, as mentioned. The Train at Platform 4, a comedy drama by Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis, is on Radio 4 at 2:15. History's Secret Heroes, Ramon Guerem, an escape artist, is on Radio 4 at 3:30. The Genius of Joy, the story of Beethoven's Ninth, is on Classic FM at 7 p.m. While staying with Beethoven, Radio 3 in concert includes Beethoven's 8th Symphony and 2nd, Radio 3, 7:30 p.m. While the Blues Show with Keris Matthews starts your working week, Monday night, 9 o'clock, Radio 2. Tuesday, May 7th, and drama Song of the Reed, Bittern, final part of the drama set in the Norfolk Wetlands, on Radio 4 at 2:15. True Crime, 1599, a history of true crime first put on the stage 400 years ago. Radio 4 for this at 4 o'clock on Tuesday. Thanks a lot, Milton Jones, the king of one-liners, solves problems with his friends on Radio 4 Comedy at 6:30. While relaxed evenings with Zeb Soans, Classic FM, 7 p.m. Wednesday, May 8th, and the drama The Mislives of Max and Judy, Part 1, a time-warping rom-com on Radio 4 at 2:15. Behind the Crime, Part 1, Is It Possible to Prevent Crime by Understanding Its Root Causes? Radio 4 for this at 3:30 on Wednesday afternoon. Room 101 with Paul Merton and Giles Brandith is on Radio 4 at 6:30 on Wednesday. Radio 3 in concert, Beethoven's 5th Piano Concerto, The Emperor, is on Radio 3 at 7:30 on Wednesday. While Being Roman with Mary Beard, The Lives of Roman Citizens Pieced Together from Scattered Clues, Radio 4, 9 o'clock. Thursday, May 9th, and the drama The Mislives of Max and Judy, on Radio 4 at 2:15. Word of mouth this week, Michael Rosen explores words and usage on Radio 4 at 3:30 in the afternoon. The Missing Hancocks, a recreation of missing episodes, is on Radio 4 Comedy at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday evening. While Radio 3 in concert, Ravel and Vaughan Williams, on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Lastly, Friday, May 10th, and drama Money Gone. It's part 3 of 5, and the Prime Minister asks MI5 to find the course of the financial chaos. Radio 4 for this, 2:15 on Friday afternoon. Like an angel passing through my room, Frida from ABBA appears as herself in a tale of a fan's unconditional love on Radio 4 Extra at 3. Dead Ringers, of course, with their topical satire on Radio 4 Comedy at 6:30 p.m. on Friday. And Friday night is, of course, Music Night, and an evening of wide choice of music presented by Patrick Trelawney, with pieces ranging from the Overture to South Pacific to Walton's March, Crown Imperial. You can hear Friday Night is Music Night now on Radio 3 at 7:30. Free Thinking, Matthew Sweet and guests look back at some themes and questions of the week. Free Thinking is now on Radio 4, of course, 9 p.m. on Friday. While Notes from Italy, tenor Freddie De Tomaso discovers the roots of Neapolitan song, Classic FM, 9 o'clock on Friday evening. That's it. Thank you to Angela for the highlights this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
Thanks very much, John. Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This is one of the many items that can be found on the Vocalise website. This time, Peter Murray from New London Architecture describes Bedford Park.
I'm Peter Murray. I'm the chairman of New London Architecture, which is London's centre for the built environment. But I'm also the secretary of the Bedford Park Society in West London. And I trained as an architect, and I've always been fascinated by buildings and also about London. I've never actually practiced, but spend my time writing about architecture and really spending a lot of time looking at it. My London landmark is where I live, Bedford Park. We moved here in the 1980s, really because of what it was. Bedford Park was the first garden suburb, started in 1875 as a radical shift away from the overcrowded, unhealthy town housing of the Victorian period. The development was the brainchild of a chap called Jonathan Carr, who bought 24 acres of land surrounding three Georgian houses, one of which Bedford Park belonged to his father-in-law. And the development was just north of Turnham Green Station, on the western fringes of London. And the original plan was for an estate of around 500 houses, designed for the middle classes, creating an eclectic mixture of styles designed to provide variety and interest, but in a way that was commercially reproducible. The railway link was important. The original marketing material made much of the ease, frequency and speed of steam trains into London. You could get into the city in under 30 minutes. It's not that quick now. But with this in mind, the houses were situated along roads which fanned out from the station. In a recent lecture for the Bedford Park Society, eminent planner Sir Peter Hall praised the dendritic layout, i.e. that the roads were like roots spreading out from the station. The streets themselves are tree-lined and spacious, some of the trees being part of the original parkland. In the 19th century, Bedford House had been owned by the famous horticulturist Dr. John Lindley, so many of the trees he planted were incorporated into the plan and built around to create a village feel. Carr's first choice of architect was E.W. Godwin, who was involved in the aesthetic movement. His initial designs weren't very well received, and he resigned. His successor was the influential Richard Norman Shaw, who produced a series of practical designs described in the publicity as the picturesque Queen Anne style. Plans were for detached, semi-detached and terrace houses, mostly three stories high, with the upper story contained within the roof. The number of different designs can be disputed, but there were probably about half a dozen. And the idea was to mix these basic house types along the streets to create an environment which had unity, but not conformity. The unity comes through shared building materials, but there's also considerable variation in the detailing. The houses are mainly deep red brick with steep pitched roofs and tall chimneys. Much of the brick came from the brickfields of nearby Acton. Sash windows and other details such as doors, porches, barge boards and fences are picked out with white paint. Some of the houses have bay windows which rise the full three stories, the bays themselves stuccoed and painted white. In some, the upper story juts forward in the manner of a Tudor timber frame building. Other houses have a wide bow window on the ground floor only, topped with a flat-lidded roof. A number of buildings have their gable ends clad in hanging terracotta tilework, rows of straight tiles layered with rows of scalloped tiles, like the scales of a fish. Others have more elaborate Dutch gables that sweep up and are topped with semicircular arches. The houses share a cottagey feel, a reaction against the classical architecture of the time. They're designed from the inside out, meaning that the layout was the most important thing. Whereas in classical architecture, the facade was designed first and everything else had to fit in, the resulting forms here were asymmetrical, emerging from the ground plan and the way the building was used. The estate became very fashionable in the 1880s, attracting a number of artistic residents, actors, poets, painters. W.B. Yeats, Pissarro and the playwright Pinero all lived here. A series of nine coloured lithographs, commissioned by Carr in 1882 and produced by local artists, give Bedford Park a utopian feel, a light, airy, clean environment with well-spaced houses, the edges softened by leafy trees and shrubs. Places where gentlemen and ladies could meet and pass the time of day. Children could bowl hoops along empty streets and dogs could lay basking in the sun. Another of the great selling points from Carr's point of view is health. A garden and a bathroom with hot and cold water to every house, whatever its size, he promised. He trumpeted the fact that the annual death rate was under 6 per 1,000. Houses were deliberately built without basements, a key part of the housing reform movement which considered basements unhealthy. Carr also wanted to create a community rather than just a series of houses. So the plans for Bedford Park included a church, a pub and a club, which he paid for himself. There was tennis, masquerades, balls, plays, lectures on scientific and political issues, a whole programme of talks and lectures. There was also a school of art. Being fashionable, of course, the place came in for some gentle satire. Bedford Park even got its own ballad. "I will seek out a brighter spot," continued Mr. Carr, "not too far from London, and yet not what you might call too far. 'Tis there a village I'll erect, with Norman Shaw's assistance, where men may lead a chaste, correct, aesthetical existence." In World War II, about 30 houses suffered bomb damage, and the estate went into something of a decline. Windows, fences, doors were replaced with little thought given to stylistic consistency, each one chipping away at the character and identity of the place. Plaster, paintwork was dilapidated, gardens unkempt. Then, in the 1960s, Acton Council demolished some of the original houses. This led one resident, Tom Greaves, to campaign to save the estate and the formation in 1963 of the Bedford Park Society. Greaves' campaign came to the attention of John Betjeman, who championed its preservation, and the Society's main aim was achieved in 1967 when the government agreed to list the greater part of the estate, a total of 356 houses. A few years later, both Ealing and Hounslow councils designated Bedford Park a conservation area. The Bedford Park Society still exists today, though its role is to work with the local councils to monitor change and maintenance, advising local residents and commenting on all planning applications. Some of the houses now go for millions of pounds, and people spending that amount of money on a property sometimes wonder why they can't do what they like with it. But although the houses are no longer within the reach of people of moderate means that Jonathan Carr aimed them at, the new residents of Bedford Park do have the means to invest in the fabric of the place, so the houses are generally in better condition than they ever have been. As our knowledge of the history of Bedford Park has increased, some have questioned the claim to be the first garden suburb. Certainly, Bedford Park differs from the later garden city movement in a number of ways. It wasn't developed cooperatively, public spaces weren't included, it was aimed at a middle-class market, and there was a pub. But there's no doubt it was the most prominent manifestation of a move towards a new sensibility in domestic architecture, influenced by the arts and crafts movement, and set within a green environment of trees and gardens. And with its emphasis on easy access to public transport, Bedford Park continues to influence planners today. As John Betjeman wrote in The Telegraph in 1960, Bedford Park is probably the most significant suburb in the Western world, one of our most charming and important monuments. Nor is its usefulness past.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning, here from TNF Soundings is a list of audio described programmes available on television, courtesy of our friends at the Wharfdale Talking Newspaper.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio-described TV programmes starting Saturday, 4th of May, to Friday, 10th of May, 2024. The usual afternoon and evening schedules on BBC One and BBC Two are affected this weekend by coverage of the World Snooker Championships. So let's start with Saturday, the 4th of May. Nigella showcases her favourite breakfast and a Thai noodle dish in Simply Nigella on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. The Oscar-winning period romantic drama Sense and Sensibility is the afternoon film at 1:25 p.m. on Film 4. Bettany returns to Azerbaijan for more adventures on the Silk Roads in tonight's episode of Bettany Hughes Treasures of the World on Channel 4 at 7 p.m. The five contenders are tested on how they would fit into the local community in Our Dream Farm with Matt Baker on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. In tonight's hospital drama, during a tense shift, Ian discovers Teddy's secret. Dylan and Stevie try to prove that Patrick is a danger to patients, and Jacob questions his capabilities as a grandfather. Casualty is on BBC One at 8:30 p.m. Sarah works with McInvan to prevent another explosion before making decisions about their future in the finale of the forensics drama Traces at 9:20 p.m. on BBC One. Now on to Sunday, 5th of May. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. How about a walk in the country this afternoon? Join the property expert and his pooch, Luna, as they follow Alfred Wainwright's picturesque coast-to-coast path in Great British Dog Walks with Phil Spencer at 5:35 p.m. on Channel 4. A fabulous Bengal tiger hunting in the forests of India opens the final episode of the nature documentary Mammals on BBC One at 7 tonight. Police response officer Chris is trying to keep out of trouble, but he is soon drawn into a drug war between two of Liverpool's major dealers. A new series of the crime drama The Responder starts tonight on BBC One at 9 p.m. Time to listen to more amateur pianists, this week at Cardiff Central Station, where we have triplets, a man on a piano bike singing about conkers, and an angelic Welsh performance which reduces the judges to tears. The piano is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. This is followed by a documentary as cameras catch up with the youngster who rose to fame after the first series of The Piano. Lucy, who is blind and neurodivergent, stole the nation's hearts after being discovered performing at Leeds railway station. The incredibly talented Lucy is on Channel 4 at 10:05. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15, Bargain Hunt is at 12:15, Doctors is at 1:30 on Monday and 1:45 Tuesday to Thursday, and Escape to the Country is at 3 p.m. All these programmes are on BBC One. Great Coastal Railway Journeys is on BBC Two at 2:15 p.m. Tuesday to Friday. There are two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV3 at 5:55 and 6:55 p.m. Monday to Friday. Let's see what's on offer for Bank Holiday Monday, the 6th of May. The early evening film starring Roger Moore as James Bond is the spy adventure Live and Let Die on ITV4 at 6:25 p.m. The chef, Marcus Waring, travels to Provence on a mission to uncover the secrets of simple French food in a new series. Marcus Waring, Simply Provence at 6:30 p.m. on BBC Two, and continuing at the same time each evening, Monday to Thursday this week. It's a knockout week, and the first eight hopefuls tackle an invention test in tonight's MasterChef at 8 p.m. on BBC One. Jamie Oliver celebrates the bounty of the spring garden, cooking asparagus spears wrapped in streaky bacon, using spring greens in a ravioli dish, and purple sprouting broccoli as a pizza topping. Jamie Cooks Spring is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. As Lee rises to the top, Shane is under pressure from Canning to get results. The drama Blue Lights is on BBC One at 9 p.m. Moving on to Tuesday, 7th of May. Alice Roberts is in the north of Britain, where a team in Carlisle have found a huge Roman bathhouse underneath a cricket ground. Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. Two walkers are cut off by the tide on the Somerset coast. A paddleboarder is swept out to sea, and a 70th birthday party is brought to an abrupt halt when a leisure boat starts taking on water. These are just some of the emergencies featured in tonight's Saving Lives at Sea on BBC Two at 8 p.m. This week, healthy and wholesome foods are pitched to the Managing Director of Buying in Aldi's Next Big Thing on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A brilliant but troubled striker gives the cobblers a lifeline, while keen birdwatcher Alan hears about a pelican on the loose. Changing Ends is on ITV1 at 8:30 p.m. In this documentary, Salman Rushdie talks to Alan Yentob about the devastating effects of being attacked with a knife in August 2022 at a literary event in New York. Salman Rushdie, Through a Glass Darkly, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. On to Wednesday, 8th of May. Knockout Week continues as the second group of eight remaining amateurs tackle the invention test in MasterChef at 8 p.m. on BBC One. Several choices at 9 tonight. The teams navigate the full length of Thailand to reach the next checkpoint in Koh Phi Phi. Race Across the World is on BBC One at 9. A new three-part documentary series starts tonight, documenting tensions during the Cold War when the West and the Soviet Union come close to nuclear war. Secrets and Spies, A Nuclear Game is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Stacey shares a host of money-saving ideas to help a couple in Cambridgeshire with a budget of £10,000 to install a kitchen and transform the ground floor of their 1970s semi. Stacey Solomon's Renovation Rescue is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Another chance to hear this programme from 2016, as Sir David Attenborough shares highlights of his life and career. Attenborough at 90 is on BBC 4 at 9 p.m. A group of passengers on a late-night train get stuck inside a tunnel when the train breaks down. The Dark Anthology returns for a ninth and final series. Inside Number 9 is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Thursday, 9th of May. At RAF Alconbury in Cambridgeshire, archaeologists have discovered a rural Roman site with mysteriously placed objects beneath the decommissioned airbase's runways. Digging for Britain is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. In a new reality game show starting tonight, pairs of contestants are given £250, which they must double in 36 hours if they are to go through to the next episode and avoid being eliminated. Double the Money is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. A killer is on the loose in the Yorkshire Dales, leaving clues behind for investigators to find, and only Terry and Gemma's knowledge of coach tours can help the police. The final episode of Murder, They Hope, is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Maggie Smith stars as eccentric bag lady Miss Shepherd in tonight's comedy drama film The Lady in the Van, based on Alan Bennett's memoir and play. Showing on Alan Bennett's 90th birthday, this is on BBC Four at 9 p.m. Finally, we come to Friday, 10th of May. Knockout Week draws to a close as this week's best cooks return to compete for a place in the semi-finals. MasterChef is on BBC One at 7:30 p.m. When breakthroughs are made in both cases, the stakes are raised and loyalties are put to the test, leaving Lindo questioning who can be trusted. Granite Harbour is on BBC One at 8 p.m. In round two, the remaining teams have 3 days to turn £500 into £1,000. Double the money is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. In this episode of Father Brown on the Drama Channel at 8, Susie is drawn to the charismatic leader of the Church of Apollo. The series following the painstaking work of conservators across Britain returns with a look at a 16-sided house in Devon and a property in Dorset where a 2,000-year-old obelisk is in jeopardy. Hidden Treasures of the National Trust is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. We end the week with the late-night film, a remake of a classic Western starring Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt and Ethan Hawke. When a ruthless land baron sets about persecuting the residents of a small town, a young widow turns to bounty hunter Sam Chisholm for help, but he's going to need a little help if he is to restore order. The Magnificent Seven is on ITV1 at 11:15 p.m. I hope you can find something that might interest you from my selection of programmes.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Eternal Feelings by local composer Gothby. Now from TNF Soundings, how teaching breakdance to people with visual impediments can bring benefits.
Rationale Arts is a registered charitable organisation which aims to promote, improve and maintain public education and appreciation of the arts. And that's the arts in all its forms, like, for example, but not exclusively, dance, music and theatre. And they do this by putting on workshops in all these areas. And one dance type that they found can be of particular benefit to people, and that most definitely includes anyone who's blind or partially sighted, is breakdance. In fact, one could go as far as to say that this type of dance can be of particular benefit to someone with sight loss because it can improve spatial awareness. And before you start thinking that breakdancing is only for the very young, think again. As we here at PSSI Talk discovered when we spoke to Nathan Gearing, Creative Director of Rationale Arts, it's for anyone with the right can-do mindset. So, to get our correct bearings on this subject, we first asked Nathan to define just what breakdance is.
Breakdance is a dance form that is part of hip-hop culture that basically involves your entire body. So, for example, you can do a lot of movements where you stood up dancing, but a lot of movements also happen when your both hands and feet are on the floor. Your bum can be sat on the floor at some point doing breakdancing. Your back can be on the floor. You can even be upside down doing headstands. So, it really is an art form that really does incorporate the entire body. And what's great about it is it gets the dancer used to the floor. So if they're afraid of falling or afraid of making contact with the floor, breakdance is a great way to get used to the floor in a very safe way.
Is it possible? I mean, it sounds exciting. It is exciting as a dance form, of course. But is there a kind of age at which people might think, oh, this might be a bit past me? Or is it just down to an individual's mobility?
It's down to the individual, basically. So, for example, we've taught children as young as like 3 years old. We've taught people right up to their 70s at the Royal Opera House. We taught them breakdance. We've had them upside down doing handstands and everything. So there's no real like kind of like age limit on it. It's just a case of if you have the can-do mindset that, you know, I want to try this out, then, you know, we can cater the dance movements to your mobility and ability level.
As creative director of Rationale Arts, I know that accessibility is kind of at the core of everything that you as an organisation, but you personally also really go for. How have you come up with a new way of looking at breakdance to make it accessible to, and in fact, so it can benefit people with some sort of vision impairment?
Basically, as I mentioned before, with breakdancing, like a lot of the movements kind of like happen on the floor and things. And a lot of people with visual impairment, they can fall and get injured. And so what breakdancing does is it heightens your spatial awareness as well. But there's a certain element of breakdancing known as go-downs, where you learn to go from standing to the ground in a variety of safe ways, but also really fun and engaging ways as well. So my charity, what we do is we teach breakdance as a means of injury prevention and to improve spatial awareness. So actually, it becomes like a life skill.
It sounds to me like it's dance, but so much more as well. You're talking about spatial awareness. You're talking about the kind of movement when you were describing what breakdance is. There seem to be a lot of elements to it that can perhaps benefit people in many ways.
Yeah, obviously, like I say, it can increase your mobility, it can increase your fitness, it can increase your understanding of the space around you. But also, because it's a social dance, it can also help to combat social isolation. You know, you can learn it with your peers and, yeah, just have a great time.
And when it comes to the teaching of it, and you were very keen to say that this really can be for people of just about any age, as long as they've got a bit of flexibility in their body, how do you start to approach it? When people first turn up, how do you teach this?
Well, first thing I'll do is I'll just have a quick physical evaluation of what their movement range is. And then from there, I'll just decide what movements will be best suitable to start them off with. And then I'll just teach them by giving like a very simple spoken word instruction, followed by kind of a sound effect. So they get an idea of the quality of movement as well. So for example, I may say, okay, I want you to crouch down low to the floor and spin. So the sound effect that may accompany that may be, so they get an idea of like how fast they need to spin and what the quality of the movement would feel like as well. So that's how we go about teaching everybody.
Sounds very much like it's tailor-made. I mean, you talked about assessing someone beforehand. That sounds like a really sensible thing to do because we're all different, aren't we? And we all move in different ways. So you tailor it, is that fair to say?
Yeah, 100%. Like, so for example, with what we've done, we've also worked in children's hospitals as well and things, and we've taught people with brittle bone disease, leukemia, traumatic brain injury. This one young person I taught, he could only move his eyes. He couldn't move the rest of his body. So I made sure we did like a dance routine, which just incorporated him kind of like moving his eyes in different directions. And within that, the specialists were actually able to then help diagnose him more. So they said that by seeing him move his eyes to the intricate rhythms of the music, they were able to know actually this person is high functioning as opposed to being low functioning. And so now we just need to make that brain and body connection with him more. So then that actually increased his recovery time.
That's an amazing story. Dance, of course, has always been seen as something that is therapeutic for the person themselves, just doing it. I don't know, is it the endorphins or whatever it is, but it's something in the body that just kind of feels better because you're moving around. I mean, do you get that kind of feedback from people you're teaching?
Yeah, 100%. You know, it is definitely down to the endorphins moving around the body. And it's always better to be outside of just your brain and make sure you get yourself inside of your body. Because the more you get yourself in your body, the more you start moving. And like I say, even if you've got very, very limited mobility, the more you can start moving, one, the more it'll increase your mobility over time. But two, you know, it just makes you kind of like feel good.
And Nathan, where are you teaching this at the moment?
Currently, we have sessions happening in Sheffield at Concord Sports Centre on a Tuesday that start at 4:45 p.m. and run till 5:45 p.m.
I was going to ask, from where you've started it in Sheffield, whether you feel it's something that you can take further afield, or indeed, could you train others to train vision impaired people wherever they are in the UK?
100%. So what we've done is we've done a variety of things. So I have a team that I've trained up. So they teach in various areas for myself as well and the charity. We've actually taught at places like the Joseph Clark School for the Blind down in London, the Royal Opera House in London. We've taught at the RNC down in Hereford. So we've taught all over the place, but we've also delivered Zoom sessions as well. So during the pandemic, we started delivering one-to-one Zoom sessions.
I don't want to put you on the spot. It would be unfair to do that. But does that mean that if someone's listening to this and they're a member of perhaps of a social group that might meet up locally, would you be open to at least an approach for an invitation for you or one of your team to travel somewhere to teach this, or at least to hold one session to get people off the ground with it?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, we're always open for new collaborations, and where we can, we want to spread the good work that we're doing. And we really want to give people the opportunity to have a positive association with movement and with their bodies and just to have a great time. So, yeah, by all means, please get in touch with us.
So there's the invitation. Wherever you're listening, if you'd like to talk to Nathan and the team at Rationale Arts about having a go at their unique and accessible breakdance workshops, you can contact Nathan Gearing by phoning 07719 317 013. That's 07719 317 013. Or you can email him at Nathan, N-A-T-H-A-N, at Rationale Arts, R-A-T-I-O-N-A-L-E, Rationale Arts, A-R-T-S, all one lowercase word, .com. That's Nathan at rationalearts.com. And full details of what they offer can be found on their website at www.rationalearts.com.
Once again, I'm delighted to welcome back Peter Burley with his take on events and entertainment upcoming in our area. Peter.
Right, well, we're now looking at events from mid-May to mid-June 2024. And amazingly, we're making this recording on what feels like the first day since winter ended. So maybe the events will seem more seasonal than they might have done. Well, let's go to the cathedral. And we've got an event on the 24th and 25th of May. It's at 7:30 p.m. both evenings, and it's the music of ABBA by candlelight. Tickets range from a VIP ticket at £45, maybe you meet the hologram for £45, down to £10 with no view. It says it's an incredible evening, and it features UK's leading ABBA tribute act, who are called ABBA Reunion. Now, there was an event called Hearts Musical Memories with the Clover Choir. That's Sunday the 26th of May at 1 p.m. It's a performance, I think, probably in the Crossing. It's free and donations are welcome. And this year, Musical Memories will be joined, say, by the Clover Choir to celebrate the joy of music and its powerful impact on people with dementia. Now, we have another musical event, 31st of May. Heather Small will be live in the cathedral. The doors for her open at 6:30, and then there's an evening's warm-up for her, and she actually starts singing at 9:15 in the evening. It's standing only. That's the bad news. The good news from that point of view is it's sold out already. There may, however, obviously be return tickets. Then we've got a talk on the 5th of June at 7:30 p.m. in the Alban Room, and that's a room in the new block just to the left-hand side of the entrance. It's a very nice room. I've been there a number of times. And it's English shrines and their female visitors in the Middle Ages. And it's being given by Dr. Anne Bailey, who's an archaeologist, and it links in with the Auburn pilgrimage. Then on the 8th of June, we have the International Organ Festival Prize Winners Gala Concert. That's at 6:30 p.m. It's free, and some top prize winners are returning to celebrate the Organ Festival. And we have a very, very different event on the 14th of June at 6:30 p.m. It's a murder mystery. Death at the Dinner Club, anyway, in the Abbot's Kitchen. So it's an event taking place just in the Abbot's Kitchen, and it's going to be one of those murder mysteries where you have to try and guess who the murderer is. Doors open at 6:30. Tickets are £60, but that does include a three-course meal and two glasses of wine. And the play is set in 1925, and it's very much an Agatha Christie sort of tribute-type performance. Now, at St Peter's Church, we seem to be fully open and firing at all cylinders. 15th of May, we have the first of their 1 p.m. lunchtime Wednesday concerts. That's 15th of May, and that's the Ivan Rodriguez Deb, it says. Not sure what Deb, whether Deb's a name or something musical. Anyway, it's a piano, and he'll be performing on the piano and the cello, probably not simultaneously. 22nd of May, we have the Amalfi Trio. 29th of May, Phoenix Mandolins. 5th of June, Armin Newband, Anna De Hare and Mark Lacey. And that's going to be violin, piano and clarinet. And finally, 12th of June, Kwan Yi Chan will be performing on the piano. Now, the St Albans Chamber Orchestra have a concert on Saturday the 18th of May at 7:30 p.m. And that will be in St Saviour's Church. And they'll be performing Prokofiev's Symphony No. 1, Haydn's Cello Concerto in C, Humperdinck's Hummus-esque, and Schubert's Symphony No. 3. Tickets for that in advance are £15 or £18 on the door. Right, then we'll move on to the Auburn Arena and the Eric Morecambe Centre. At the Auburn Arena, we've got quite a packed programme, and we're going to start off on Wednesday the 15th of May at 7:30 p.m. with a programme called Most Haunted, and it's acclaimed as the world's number one paranormal show. Tickets for that will cost you £31.50. Then we have Julian Clary, A Fistful of Clary, and that's a one-man show by Julian Clary, Thursday the 16th of May, 7:30 p.m. You have to be over 16, and it will cost you £31. Then we have Steel Eye Span, the concert, and that's a tribute band. It's the folk rock pioneers are doing Steel Eye Span music, and that'll be on Friday the 17th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets £31.50 or £28.50. We have Jimmy Carr in this year's one-man show. Jimmy Carr laughs funny, and he'll be laughing funny on Saturday the 18th of May, twice, once at 7 p.m. and the second time at 9:30 p.m. You have to be over 16, and all tickets are £37. Then we have a show, another tribute show to Tina Turner, What's Love Got to Do With It? And that's going to be on Sunday the 19th of May at 7:30 p.m. Tickets for that are £33 down to £20. Then we have Don't Stop Believin', and that's a tribute rock show to various bands from the 70s, 80s and 90s, and that will cost you £30. Then we have Sing at the Musicals, and that's a show with a live band, and you sing along to the live band with famous songs from the musicals, and that will cost you £28.50, even though you'll be the performer. Then we have Stranger Sings, which is a show on Friday the 31st of May, 7:30 p.m. And join us, it says, in this upside down for this award-winning smash hit new parody musical, Stranger Sings. It's apparently a Broadway hit, now touring in the UK. You need to be over 12 to attend this, and all tickets are £40. Then another tribute concert, a tribute to the Bee Gees, Jive Talkin', and that'll be Saturday the 1st of June, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £27. And then we have on the 13th of June, Shalimar's Greatest Hits Tour. Now, this is actually not a tribute band, but is Shalimar, and tickets for them are going to be £44, all the way down to £34.50. And finally, we have the Red Hot Chili Pipers. Remember Pipers and not Peppers, a tribute band to the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And it will feature some dancers who performed with them. That's on Friday the 14th of June, 8 p.m. £46, £36, or a VIP ticket for £80. Now, let's head north to the Eric Morecambe Centre. Friday the 24th of May, we have a one-man show by Henry Cole. And this will be a break between his busy schedule to bring an evening of happy days to you. And it's hosted by his good friend, renowned prankster, Steve Stravros. I must admit, he's a performer below my horizon. Anyway, he'll be £32. Then we have, on Saturday the 1st of June at 7:30 p.m, the Johnny Cash Roadshow, another tribute act, and that'll be obviously Johnny Cash's songs, £28.50 all tickets. And finally, we have got a girls' night out on Wednesday the 12th of June at 7:30 p.m. And it's a show as seen on TV. And it will cost you £28. Now, we've got two events at the Abbey Theatre. We have got, from the 18th to the 19th of May, 7:30 p.m. both evenings, a play called Ladies Who Lunch. And it's music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. And it's going to be on the main stage, and all tickets will be £20. And then we have a play which was, I think, quite a successful film last year called Pressure. I'm not sure if the film was called Pressure. It's about the drama behind the weather forecasting in the lead up to the D-Day landings. And it's by David Haig, and he is in fact an actor as well as a playwright, being performed by the Company of Ten. And as I say, it's this drama of actually exactly when to launch the invasion. Now, the play runs from the 7th to the 15th of June, 8 p.m. all evenings, with a Sunday matinee on the 9th of June at 2:30 p.m. Now, let's go to the museum and remind you, as always, the regular talks on Roman themes at the Verulamium Museum. But we've got one other relevant event in our period at the Verulamium Museum itself, and that's at 7 p.m. on the 17th of May. And this is the talk entitled Rituals and Rubbish in Roman Rivers. And it's about why so many important archaeological finds we made in rivers. The talk is being given by Dr. Philippa Watson. It will cost you £10. And although it starts at 7 p.m, you're invited to turn up to the museum early to have a look at some of the exhibits which will interact with the lecture. There is a stern warning in the programme, though, that this event is only suitable for adults, although I think for different reasons from the same warning for other events. Then we've got one last talk from Sahas in our period, and it's the last talk before they shut down for the, I think, for the summer. It's Tuesday the 21st of May. It's going to be in Dagnall Street Baptist Church, which is a change of venue for them. So they'll be trying that out, but it will also be broadcast on Zoom. Say Tuesday the 21st of May, 7:45, and it's John Walwood, their president, talking about the Bayer tapestry, new threads on old linen. And we're all just hoping it doesn't come unravelled. And lastly, one more talk. We've got a talk by the Harbordon Local History Society, and that's at 8 p.m. in Function Room Number 1 at the Eric Morecambe Centre. And that's on the 28th of May, and it's on the history and work of the Harpenden Trust. And it's given by Richard Nichols, who is chair of the Harpenden Trust. Now, there was a big event at the Eric Morecambe Centre, I think a couple of weeks ago. I forgot what they're called now, but where all the different groups who give help, usually to older people, come together to put on a display. And apparently, I didn't get to it, but it was very good, I'm told. And I think the Harpenden Trust probably was one of the contributors. And lastly, more of a warning than an advert. Don't go to Redbourne on the 25th or 26th of May. It's the county show and everything gridlocks around there. So that's those 2 days, all day, the county show in Redbourne. So hope to see you next month.
New York City, like London, has wonderful buildings and monuments. Here, Congressman Charles Rangler describes the Apollo Theatre, one of my favourite theatrical venues.
Hello, I'm Congressman Charles Rangler, and I represent the 15th Congressional District, which includes East and Central Harlem, the Upper West Side, Washington Heights, and Inwood. I'm happy that I can describe this wonderful Apollo Theatre for you. My New York office is on 125th Street, just a block away from the Apollo that really lights up 125th Street from river to river. I was born not far away from the Apollo, and I still live right there in the community. And the Apollo all of my life has been so important to me because it brought people to life that I've just dreamed about or heard about. The address is 253 West on 25th Street. It was built in 1914 as a burlesque theater. Back then, African Americans weren't even allowed in the audience, but by the mid-1930s, the Apollo and its world's famous amateur night shows had become the most important venues in the nation for emerging and established African American performers, such as Ella Fitzgerald, Bessie Smith, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday, Count Basie, Duke Ellington. All of these people got their starts with a slogan, "The place where stars are born and legends are made." Now, here's what the theater looks like. I can describe it from looking directly across the street. The building is 3 stories tall, so it's not very imposing. But you can recognize the Apollo from blocks away in 125th Street because of a tall vertical sign recently attached to the front of the building. The sign has the words Apollo spelled out in 4-foot-high big red letters that shine from avenue to avenue. The letters are in neon, and they stand out dramatically against the background of the sign, which is a pale yellow. The sign is 27 feet tall, about half of the sign, extending across the roof line of the building. And it is two-sided, so you can see it from either side, east or west, on 125th Street. The facade of the building has 2 distinct areas. The first floor with a box office, the theater entrance, and the theater marquee, and the 2 stories above the marquee. First, the 2 upper stories, they're constructed of marble, a very light gray in color. Each story has 4 large windows. The style of these 2 stories is called neoclassical, which means inspired by the architecture of ancient Greece and Rome. On the Apollo, neoclassical details includes Ionic pilasters and a balustrade across the roof line. A pilaster looks like a column, but it projects only slightly from the wall. So it's not a real column. It doesn't support any real weight. As a matter of fact, it's just a decoration. The Apollo has 3 tall pilasters that separate the windows and extend to the height of the 2 stories. Their tops have a distinctive scroll shape that's called Ionic. The other neoclassical detail is the balustrade, which extends across the entire roof line of the building. A balustrade is a balcony railing, but like the pilasters, this balustrade is only decorative, not a real rating, so it only projects slightly from the facade. But most people will not notice these details. Their attention will be drawn by the glowing neon lights of the Apollo sign and the street-level entrance and marquee. As you approach the Apollo, the entrance consisting of 4 glass doors is on the left, and the ticket windows on the box office are on the right. But the most distinctive thing about the street level is the 3-sided theater marquee. It is wide as half the building and extends from the building facade all the way across the sidewalk to the curb. The 3 sides of the marquee are white electronic screens, about 5 feet high, where the theater promotes upcoming performances in black letters. The 2 sides of the marquee facing the sidewalk are topped by a smaller horizontal version of the huge Apollo sign I mentioned before. These signs also spell out the word Apollo in big red neon letters about 18 inches high against a pale yellow background. The Apollo Theater is officially a national, state, and New York City landmark. Over 1 million people visit every year, and I hope you have a chance to attend a performance and take one of their guided tours of the interior of the theater. Maybe you can even attend a world-famous amateur night show and hear the newest stars that are being born at the world-famous Apollo Theater.
Before I wrap up with a week in history, here, from TNF Soundings, Amanda reads The Sort by Jeff Saunders.
Hi there. This is Amanda here with something a little bit different, a bit of drama. I have a friend, Mr. Jeff Saunders, who is a teacher, a writer, and an actor. He's written quite a few short pieces for performance in the theatre, and I have been fortunate enough to be asked by him to read some of them. This particular short piece called The Sort is one of my favourites, and I'm delighted to be able to present it to you today, and I do hope that you enjoy it. She was the sort of person who specialised in telling other people the sort of person she was. "I am the sort of person who just comes out with it," she would say. "I'm sassy and spirited, and I don't mince my words," which was her way of justifying the frequent occasions on which she was spectacularly rude. "I was just being honest," she said, as a friend, or soon-to-be ex-friend, wept across a restaurant table. "I'm the sort of person who doesn't deal in bullshit," which was meant to get her off the hook, we thought, while helping the soon-to-be ex-friend to her Uber, confirming with her that actually her engagement ring was beautiful and bore no relation to the one in the catalogue to which I'm the Sort had referred. "She needed to know her husband-to-be is a cheapskate," she said. "I'm the sort of person who doesn't hold back when she can see the truth." "But what if it isn't the truth?" I asked. "What if it's just the truth as you see it? He doesn't make the sort of money you and your friends do, and you don't like him. But she loves him, and he loves her, and..." She was also the sort of person who specialised in telling other people what sort of person she considered them to be. "You're the sort of person," she said to me, waving the waiter away as he hovered with the sea bass he had been about to deliver to the bride-to-be. "You're the sort of person who likes to make excuses for people. You never have the courage to sit in judgment." "And you're the sort of person who does," I replied, realising that I shouldn't have expressed this as a question because it was in fact the answer. She made the sort of shrug made by women who wear dead animals across their shoulders. "I'm the sort of person who tells it like it is." "Tells it as she sees it," I corrected her. "Not as it is. You express an opinion as if it's a fact, but that does not make it a fact." "You're the sort of person who plays with words and tries to cancel free speech," she hissed. The sort who calls people out for being utter," and I completed the sentence with a word I won't write down. "How childish," she said. "Such language marks you as the sort of person who calls out nasty, mean-minded so-called friends." Bride-to-be returned at this point. "I'm so sorry," she said to I'm the Sort. "I took your coat by mistake." She handed the coat back to its owner. "And there I was, thinking you must be the sort of person who had lots of money after your comments about my ring," she said. "Unless acrylic is the new cashmere, of course." "I'm the sort of person who takes a malicious delight in seeing people get their comeuppance. Don't judge me."
Finally, let's have a look at events and birth dates in the past, which happened in this upcoming week. On the 5th of May 1921, Coco Chanel officially launched her Chanel No. 5 perfume at her boutique on the Rue Cambon in Paris. The new fragrance immediately revolutionised the perfume industry and has remained popular for over a century. Despite humble beginnings, the daughter of a clothing peddler and laundry woman, Gabrielle Coco Chanel, quickly established herself on the Paris fashion scene. By 1921, she had become a celebrated clothing designer and socialite, known for her groundbreaking designs and larger-than-life public image. Even before its debut, Chanel No. 5 caused a stir. At a party she hosted for her most fashionable friends, Chanel sprayed the perfume around the table and, according to legend, was asked about the scent by every woman who passed by. Over 100 years later, the perfume is as recognisable and enduring as Chanel's most famous clothing designs and the designer herself. On the 6th of May 1994, at a ceremony presided over by Queen Elizabeth II and French President François Mitterrand, a rail tunnel under the English Channel was officially opened, connecting Britain and the European mainland for the first time since the Ice Age. The Channel Tunnel, or Channel, connects Folkestone with Coquelles in France, 31 miles away. The channel cut travel time between England and France to a swift 35 minutes, and eventually between London and Paris to 2.5 hours. As the world's longest undersea tunnel, the Channel Tunnel runs underwater for 23 miles, with an average depth of 150 feet below the seabed. Each day, about 30,000 people, 6,000 cars, and 3,500 lorries journey through the tunnel on passenger, shuttle, and freight trains. On the 7th of May 1965, in the early hours of the morning, one of the greatest pop hooks of all time was born, when a bleary-eyed Keith Richards awoke, grabbed a tape recorder, and laid down the opening riff of "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," and then promptly fell back to sleep. When he woke up in the morning, the tape had run out, but when he put it back on, there was a 30-second, somewhat drowsy rendition of Satisfaction, followed by 45 minutes of snoring. Fellow Rolling Stone Mick Jagger recalled some years later, "Keith didn't really like it. He didn't think it was single material. And we all said, 'You're off your head.'" Which he was, of course. The song went on to sell more than 4.5 million copies and was ranked number 2 in Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. On the 8th of May 1945, streets were filled in cities across Britain, Western Europe, and the United States as people put out flags and banners to celebrate Victory in Europe Day, rejoicing in the defeat of Nazi Germany in World War II. In Prague, Germans surrendered to their Soviet antagonists. In Copenhagen and Oslo, at Karlshorst near Berlin, in northern Latvia, on the Channel Island of Sark, the German surrender was realised in a final ceasefire. More surrender documents were signed in Berlin and eastern Germany. Pockets of German-Soviet confrontation continued into the next day, and consequently VE Day was not celebrated in Moscow until the 9th of May, with a radio broadcast from Stalin himself proclaiming, "The age-long struggle of the Slav nations has ended in victory. Your courage has defeated the Nazis. The war is over." On the 9th of May 1926, if their claims are to be believed, polar explorer Richard E. Byrd and co-pilot Floyd Bennett became the first people to fly over the North Pole in the Josephine Ford, a triple-engine Fokker monoplane. The pair had taken off from Spitsbergen in Norway and reportedly covered the 1,545-mile trip to the pole and back in 15 hours and 30 minutes. However, the discovery in 1996 of the diary that Byrd had kept on his famous flight seemed to suggest that he and Bennett may have turned back 150 miles short of the pole because of an oil leak. If so, Italian adventurer Umberto Nobile, American Lincoln Ellsworth, and Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen, who was in 1911 the first person to reach the South Pole by land, would receive the credit for their airship flight over the North Pole on May 12, 1926, 3 days after Byrd and Bennett's flight. Nevertheless, Byrd's place in polar exploration is firmly set. In 1929, he established a US base in Antarctica, and, late in the same year, accompanied by aviator Bernd Balchen, he made the undisputed first aircraft flight over the South Pole. On the 10th of May 1996, 8 climbers died in a storm on Mount Everest, the worst loss of life ever on the mountain in a single day. A total of 15 people perished during the spring 1996 climbing season on Everest. Author John Krakauer, who himself attempted to climb the peak that year, wrote a best-selling book about the incident, Into Thin Air, which was published the following year. In 1996, an unprecedented 17 expeditions, including hundreds of climbers, attempted to scale the Himalayan peak. Members of the group led by Everest veterans Rob Hall and Scott Fisher were among those to perish as a powerful storm came in suddenly as they made a push for the summit. Even experienced climbers like Fisher and Hall could only struggle short distances down the peak, such was the ferocity of the storm. The pair stayed with their clients, but the continuing storm made everyone vulnerable to death as oxygen supplies ran out. Rob Hall managed to call his wife in New Zealand via satellite phone, but sadly there was nothing that could be done to save the 8 climbers. In his book, Krakauer blamed the inexperienced climbers and the guides, who had agreed to lead them in return for large sums of money, for the tragedy. On the 11th of May 1987, Klaus Barbie was put on trial in Lyon more than 4 decades after the end of World War II. The former Nazi Gestapo chief, known as the Butcher of Lyon in France, was charged with 177 crimes against humanity. As chief of Nazi Germany's secret police in Lyon, Barbie sent 7,500 French Jews and French resistance partisans to concentration camps and executed some 4,000 others. Among other atrocities, Barbie personally tortured and executed many of his prisoners. After the war, Barbie burned off his SS identification tattoo, assumed a new identity, and engaged in anti-communist activity before surrendering himself to American counterintelligence officers in 1947. He worked as a US agent in Germany for 2 years, as the Americans shielded him from French prosecutors who were trying to track him down, before being smuggled by the Americans to Bolivia in 1949. Although he was discovered by Nazi hunters Serge Klarsfeld and Beata Kunzel in 1972, it would take another 15 years, a change of leadership in Bolivia, and much legal wrangling before he was returned to France to face justice. He was found guilty of the crimes and sentenced to spend the rest of his life in prison. He died of cancer in a prison hospital in 1991. And now famous birthdays. May the 5th. Born in 1830, John B. Stetson was an American hat manufacturer and the inventor of the cowboy hat named after him. As a young man, he explored the American West. There he turned a critical eye to the impractical and flea-infested coonskin caps favored by many of the gold seekers, drovers, and cowboys that he met. In 1865, Stetson began manufacturing durable, wide-brimmed, and waterproof hats more suited to the needs of these Westerners. One observer noted, "It kept the sun out of your eyes and off your neck. It was like an umbrella. It gave you a bucket, the crown, to water your horse, and a cup, the brim, to water yourself. It made a hell of a fan, which you sometimes need for a fire, but more often to shunt cows this direction or that." The hat achieved instant popularity and was named the Boss of the Plains. It was the first real cowboy hat and became an iconic symbol of the American West. The hat gained its popular name Stetson because the words John B. Stetson Company were embossed in gold in every hat band. May the 6th. Bent Andreas Baader was a West German communist and leader of the left-wing militant organization the Red Army Faction, also known as the Baader-Meinhof Group. Born in Munich in 1943 and a high school dropout, Baader met journalist Ulrike Meinhof in 1970, when she was pivotal in his escape from prison after his arrest for arson. Under their leadership, the Red Army faction was responsible for a series of politically inspired bombings, bank robberies, kidnappings, and murders. After Baader was sentenced to life imprisonment following a shootout in Frankfurt, militants tried to force his relief by staging further kidnappings, murders, and even a commercial plane hijack in which the aircraft was flown to Mogadishu, Somalia, where the passengers were eventually freed in an assault carried out by German special forces. On learning of the special forces' success, Baader and several other imprisoned gang members agreed a suicide pact and were found dead in their cells. Aspects of these deaths have been debated. Baader was supposed to have shot himself, but there is evidence to suggest that it would have been impossible for him to do so. May the 7th. General Tito, real name Josip Broz, was a Yugoslav communist revolutionary and politician born in 1892. During World War II, he led the Yugoslav partisans, often regarded as the most effective resistance movement in German-occupied Europe. He was the chief architect of the Social Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, serving from 1944 until his death in 1980 as first prime minister, then president, and finally president for life. Tito's political philosophy was more liberal and democratic than those imposed in other communist Eastern Bloc countries. Some historians view him as authoritarian, while others characterize him as a benevolent dictator. But he was, and remains, a popular public figure, both in the former countries of Yugoslavia and abroad, and was viewed as a unifying symbol, with his internal policies maintaining the peaceful coexistence of the nations of the Yugoslav Federation. May the 8th. Born in Andalusia on this day in 1895, José Gómez Ortega, commonly known as Joselito, was one of the most famous Spanish matadors of bullfighting's golden age in the earliest 20th century, if not of all time. A third-generation bullfighter, Joselito was considered a child prodigy and was the youngest bullfighter to receive the title of maestro at the age of just 17. Despite his skills, Joselito was fatally gored in the ring by the bull named Bailador in Talavera de la Reina at the age of 25. Such was his fame that upon his death, the statue of the Virgin Mary in Seville, known as La Macarena, was dressed in an entirely black ensemble to acknowledge the public's heavy grief. May the 9th. Dog trainer, author and television personality Barbara Woodhouse was born in 1910. Her 1980 television series, Training Dogs the Woodhouse Way, made her a household name. Among her catchphrases were walkies and sit. She was also known for her no bad dogs philosophy. Woodhouse first appeared on television as a contestant on What's My Line, where panellists failed to guess her occupation. Her 1980 BBC series made her a television personality at the age of 70, and she continued to appear on television regularly until she died at the age of 78. Her autobiographical books include Talking to Animals and No Bad Dogs. She firmly believed there were no bad dogs, just bad owners, but accepted that some dogs had genetic problems, saying, "Some people get dogs they don't deserve. Hereditary faults play havoc with some dogs, such that the owner can do nothing." May the 10th. Sir Dennis Thatcher was an English businessman born in 1915. As the husband of Britain's first female Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, he became the first male Prime Ministerial spouse. Thatcher was a decorated soldier during World War II. On returning to England, he rejoined the family paint and preservatives business, and it was through this that he met his second wife, Margaret Roberts, then an industrial chemist. When she met Dennis for the first time, she described him as not a very attractive creature and very reserved, but quite nice. Even so, they married in 1951. Dennis Thatcher mostly refused press interviews and made only brief speeches. He saw his role as helping Margaret to survive the stress of her job, and she often acknowledged her husband's support. His public image was shaped by the satirical Dear Bill columns appearing since 1979 in Private Eye, which portrayed him as a juniper-sozzled, right-wing, golf-obsessed halfwit, and Dennis found it useful to play along with this image to avoid allegations of unduly influencing his wife in political matters. But while he did not exploit his position, he certainly made the most of it. He was a celebrity exclusively because of whom he had married. Dennis was granted the Thatcher Baronetcy in 1990 and remains the most recent commoner to have been awarded a hereditary title. He died in 2003. And finally, May the 11th. Dame Margaret Rutherford was an English actress of stage, film and television. Born in 1892, Rutherford's early life was overshadowed by tragedies involving both of her parents, one a murderer declared insane, the other a suicide. The possibility of inherited mental illness would haunt Margaret, and she suffered intermittent bouts of depression and anxiety all her life. A talented pianist and elocution teacher, she developed an acting career relatively late, making her stage debut only in 1925, aged 33. As her spaniel jowls and bulky frame made being cast in romantic heroine roles impossible, she established her name in comedy, appearing in many of the most successful British plays and films. "I never intended to play for laughs," she said. "I'm always surprised that the audience thinks me funny at all." Rutherford only came to national attention after World War II in the film adaptation of Noel Coward's Blithe Spirit and Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest. In the early 1960s, she starred as Agatha Christie's character Miss Marple in four films and won an Academy Award and a Golden Globe Award for her role as the Duchess of Brighton in The VIPs in 1963. At the time, she set a record for the oldest woman and last born in the 19th century to win an Oscar. She was appointed a Dame Commander in 1967. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to David, Christine, Keith, Andy, Jane and Deborah for reading the news, to John for reading the radio listings, thanks also to Peter Murray and Charles Wrangler, all at TNF Soundings, Rex and Bob for the week in history and famous birthdays, and to Peter for events and entertainment. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time. Let me take this opportunity to wish you a safe, peaceful, and hopefully warmer May. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.